Welcome to Health Tech Matters, a podcast where we talk to healthcare leaders and discuss current trends and innovative healthcare products. I'm your host, Mary, and today we're going to talk about stigmatized health conditions, designing healthcare spaces, and working with different cultures. I'd love to present our next guest, Michelle Chang. Michelle Chang, co-founder of Kamali and healthcare designer. She was designing healthcare solutions in hospitals, clinics, and senior living facilities for almost 7 years. She has a unique experience of working in Australia, China, and the UK. Today, she will share her insights with us. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Mary. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Making the most of the time now.
Yeah. So just to start with, how did you decide to go into the healthcare design?
Sure. So I think I've heard this story a lot from other people as well. But when I was young, I really loved biology and I loved art. So I didn't discover that healthcare design existed for a long time. And I grew up thinking that there were two very separate things. So you either had to choose a career in design or art or a career like pursuing sciences. So I went to university and I studied a double degree in international studies and interior and spatial design. And it was only in my last course that I discovered that there was this thing called dimension design, because I had this wonderful professor who was teaching us how to design for people who were not your typical clients. So that's really how I fell into healthcare design. I had this wonderful professor. He opened me to the world of designing for people with dementia and healthcare design, and that's where it started.
This is an interesting story because you have an experience in so many different countries. How did you decide to have these changes and why actually did you decide?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think from a young age, I've always just been very interested in seeing things that were different to what I grew up with. So when I graduated from university, my final year was in China. As part of my international studies degree, I was learning Chinese. And I learned very quickly that you can't learn a language in just 1 year. I knew I always wanted to live there a little bit longer to improve my language skills, but also because ethnically my background is Chinese. So my family came from Hong Kong and China, and I didn't know very much about them. One thing I did know was that if my parents got older, a lot of immigrants will also get dementia. And I was really interested in this question of what happens to our parents, our immigrant parents, if, you know, God forbid, but if people get dementia, what would they remember? And it's very difficult for us to design for that because we didn't grow up knowing what they lived with. So I really went there to try and figure this question out.
So you are living in Australia for some time, but your parents are originally from Hong Kong and China. You are like, as they call it, child of third culture. So you have mixed cultures, Australian, Chinese, and Hong Kongese.
Exactly. So I was born in Australia, but I was very lucky to grow up around great Chinese influences. We have a lot of extended family here too. So my parents had a restaurant. So I was very lucky every day to eat like incredible food, incredible Chinese food. So that's probably one of the things that I've taken away most in my life now is I love food, I love Chinese food, and I just love trying different foods. But it also comes a lot through like behaviors as well. So I think there are a lot of stereotypes that Asian cultures can be very strict with education. I took my education very seriously. I would like to think that that was because that's what I enjoyed.
And what about attitude to medicine and to healthcare? Because those are very different in Australia and in China. First of all, Chinese medicine is very different from anything else. Did that influence you?
I definitely grew up with some Chinese medicine influences, but I must say, because I grew up in Australia, I didn't really understand it, to be honest. That's like
not
the truth.
Yet.
Yeah, not yet. I was too young. But I think now that I'm growing up, I understand where it's coming from. A lot of traditional Western medicine is about curing, so coming in after something has happened. A lot of Chinese medicine was based on prevention. So making sure that you're building up a good health to ward off any, I guess, potential health issues later on. Of course, there are overlaps, and I think especially now things are changing a lot. We are looking a lot more at prevention and just, I guess, being healthy. So it's a bit blurred these days.
Prevention is definitely something that we should work on, especially in our culture.
You can never be too early to start. Just being good to your body, being good to your health.
Yeah, totally agree. And what about your work experience?
So after my university degree finished, that was around 2014, I went straight into working in Beijing. So during my university years as well, I was already working for a firm in Sydney, designing senior living facilities. So that really sort of like kickstarted my interest in this area, and I wanted to continue it in China. So I found a great company in China, in Beijing, and I was working there for 4 years, and I was designing mainly clinics, hospitals, and senior living facilities, specifically looking at designing wards for people with dementia. In 2018, I moved to London and I was working from remote, so still designing a lot of healthcare facilities. And then around end of 2018, I decided I wanted to start my own business. I wanted to explore the startup world, and I found a great opportunity to join an incubator. So as you might know, London is a great hub for startups, and there are a lot of opportunities here. There was a great opportunity to join this incubator called Zinc. And what interested me to this incubator was that, unlike other startup programs, this one was focused around a mission. And the mission was to add 5 high quality years to later life. So it's really about building businesses that had a social impact and were looking to help support the aging population.
Mm-hmm. And your brand Provi, which is part of Commonly, is all about disposable underwear. Why did you choose this topic?
So I didn't go in thinking that I would be looking at the problem of incontinence, but it was really through my design process of talking with older adults and trying to figure out what were some of the things that were affecting them that don't usually get mentioned. Originally, I was looking at targeting social isolation and loneliness. So I was asking a lot of questions around that. One of the reasons that they feel tied to their home and that they don't want to go out is because they have to be careful about where they go because they need a toilet in case they have a bladder leak because they're dealing with incontinence. And I looked a bit deeper into this, and it's very common. 1 in 4 people in the UK experience it. And that's around like 400 million people worldwide experience it. Just to put that into context, if it were a country, it would be the 3rd largest in the world. So a lot of people are living with incontinence, and yet you don't really hear much about it, or you think it's something that only affects really old people. That's not the case. The other big problem is that these people are living with it. It's really difficult to talk about it. And the products that they use are really dehumanizing. A lot of them look like adult nappies or diapers. People are afraid to go out sometimes because they're worried people might hear that they're wearing a diaper, or they're worried that it might show through, or that it'll look bulky. And that just felt like a design problem that could be easily solved. And I just didn't understand why no one was doing anything about it. And so that's how Provi was born. When I first heard about incontinence, I thought, and most people think, it is a physical issue. But it's a lot more complicated than that. My learning was that it also impacted, these sort of things impact also your mental, your emotional, like psychological state as well. So yes, people were dealing with bladder leaks, but they also had to deal with the stigma. They had to deal with the shame and the embarrassment. And all that affects your overall health. That is a bigger problem in itself.
Even if there is no previous negative experience with other people seeing that you have that problem, still you might be afraid of even the possibility of this situation. What is the biggest challenge for you while building Provi and Commonly?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges with building a startup from scratch. I think one of the biggest challenges has been finding people to talk about it, because it is a very taboo topic. 1 in 2 people who experience incontinence don't even go to seek professional help because it's a very stigmatized condition, people aren't talking about it. And that's a challenge. So how do you find these people to talk to understand the problem better? And how do you encourage them and create a safe space for them to talk to you? Luckily, I think now with internet, people can stay anonymous and they're happy to talk to you there. But that's just the start, really, because we know that there are so many people experiencing it. A lot of people aren't talking about it. So how do we get them to talk about it? How can we change this mindset around it?
When people start talking about it, there will be lots of people talking about it. Because, yeah,
Yeah.
it's just one click and everybody is waiting for it because they're all afraid to make this first step. And obviously, if somebody did it, I can do it because it's no longer a stigma. I'm perceived as a normal person like you and me, and we are all having some health issues. These are just different ones. So you just need to wait for this moment. Either the society develops itself, or maybe you will push it to some extent.
Yeah, there are definitely some great people who are lending their voices to talk about these topics. And we are living in a society now that is becoming more open. I mean, if we think about it, just 10, 20 years ago, people would not even talk about periods or menstruation. And now that's very common. I mean, there's still some changes and some places it's not so open to talk about yet. But I feel very privileged that in the country, in the UK, people are talking about it now. And that's been a very recent change too.
Yeah, London is a great place to start and gradually expand to other countries as they grow. And how do you think the market of underwear will be changing in the next years? So there will be more brands like yours, or there will be some different products or some innovations in this field?
I think there's going to be a lot of focus on sustainability. I think right now there is a huge focus on sustainability already, but there are a lot of material challenges and technical challenges to make that happen. There'll be a lot more reusable brands, and already there are a lot of reusable brands out there. But one of the big challenges about these reusable brands for incontinence is you must have seen there are a lot of reusable period pads. Right? And if we think about it, periods are only around 18 mils. So it's, less than a cup in your whole period over 5 days. It's very little. Whereas for people who live with incontinence, it can vary. Some people can have very little, so it can be as little as 18 mils per day. But sometimes it can be like a whole cup because your bladder can hold up to 400 milliliters of water. And so if you're wearing something that's reusable, that holds 400 mils of water, you're literally carrying like a weight around with you. So that right now there aren't great materials that are reusable that can handle that. And that's why there's still a lot of disposable products out there. And the reality is these people need something that can help them live their life. So there's still a need for these. But I do think eventually when material science catches up and we get more innovations in that area, we'll have more sustainable products.
And how did you design your product? Did you had help from some specialists focused on these materials or designing clothes? How did you do this?
Yes, yeah, so and the first thing that we did was we had to talk with the users, and we did a lot of interviews. In total, we had over 150 people that we talked to work and understand what the current problems were. So the starting point is really understanding what's wrong with the existing products, what don't they like about it, and what they want to improve. So from there, we just took in all their responses. We had to work together with some manufacturers. We were contacting manufacturers from all over the world to see what they were capable of doing and what they were capable of creating. And interestingly, in this industry, a lot of them are very similar. So it was very difficult to find a manufacturer who was willing to do something different to try and make a product that better reflected what the users wanted. So we were very lucky to find a manufacturer who was willing to work together with us. And they were already developing something very similar to what the feedback we had received was. So we worked together, we used some of the prototypes, and we were testing with the users. A lot of them, I think 85%, said it was better than their current product and they're really happy with it. So right now we have the product, but we're waiting to sell. So that's going to come later this year.
Sounds cool. So good luck with it.
Oh, thank you.
And going back to your healthcare design career, what was your favorite project, the one you are most proud of?
I've been very lucky to work on some really great projects in my time. Probably the project I'm most proud of is a clinic that we designed for an international healthcare company. So it's a very big company based in Europe. They wanted their first clinic in China. So we're very lucky to partner together with them to make this reality. And what was interesting about this project is that they didn't want to design a traditional clinic. They wanted to design something that was completely different and a patient-centered clinic. So when we think of a traditional clinic that I usually go to, you go into the doctor's office, you wait at the reception, wait for sometimes a really long time before the doctor is ready to see you, and then you go and walk in to see your doctor. Now that's very doctor-centered. So the doctor is always in their room and they're stuck there just waiting for patients to come in and out. We wanted to change that and make it patient-centered. So we had a lot of discussions with the doctors and nurses and staff who were going to be working there to implement this new model. And what eventually we did was we created a system where if you're a patient, you come into a clinic, you're greeted by a service ambassador, and they will lead you to your own patient room. So it's no longer a doctor room, it's a patient room. So you can get comfortable there. It's almost like a hotel room, but maybe without so many things really. You can get there, you can like put your coat down, you can get comfortable. And then when the doctor is ready to see you, they'll come in and you have your consultation. And that sounds like a very little change, but really what it did was it benefited not just the patients, but also the doctors. Because patients now feel like they have ownership, they've got a space, it's pretty much revolving around them, which is what care should be about. And secondly, it meant that we had to change how doctors worked. So usually in the clinic, you might have 5 to 10 doctors in the clinic. And usually they're sitting in their own separate room, waiting for patients to come in. We changed that. We gave them almost as like a staff center, but we call it a knowledge center. It's a big space for doctors to just to work, to do their admin work, to have papers, but also to have conversations. Because previously when they were in just their room, they couldn't talk to one another. There wasn't this place to have conversations or to collaborate. But now that we've created a space, it's sort of like behind the clinics, they can all come together. There's a sense of like community and they can support one another. So they're not alone. So that was a really huge change to how clinics were being run in China. It was just really exciting to try something different.
It reminds me of school because there is also a teacher's room where teachers can connect. And that's really great platform for sharing knowledge and just making yourself comfortable at your workspace. And speaking about this patient's room, how did you make this experience more relaxing for patients?
So I can give two examples of things that we did. So one of them is a lot of doctor's offices, traditionally, there would be maybe the doctor is like sitting behind a desk and then you're sitting on the other side and they've got a computer screen on the side of them. So a lot of the times when they're talking to you, they have to make notes as well. So they're typing away. And if they're not looking at the patient, then they're not giving them their undivided attention. And a lot of that comes from the design of the desk, of the layout of the room. So we created a new desk design, which is a bit more like a kidney shaped. So the doctor is almost sitting next to the patient and you're always talking directly with them. And that means the computer is put to the side. It's not the main thing in the space. So that was to facilitate a greater patient-doctor connection. The second thing we noticed was that a lot of the consultations that we have, when we go to the GP, for example, if you have a cough, you don't need to lie on the exam bed. It can be very anxiety-inducing because that's what makes it look like a doctor's office. If it was just more like a therapy office where you're just going to have a chat with a doctor, they can make feel a lot more comfortable. So you'll see nowadays a lot of patient rooms are a bit more like a consultation room. It's just a place to have a chat. And maybe there's a bed in there, but maybe there isn't. Or it could be the bed is hidden behind a screen or a separate door. Because there really isn't a need for a bed if you're not going to lie down and use it. So why make people anxious and have it there?
I totally agree. So talking about designing for people with dementia, as you mentioned, you have also worked on a project specifically for this target group. Which one is it?
So one of the major projects I did in designing for people with dementia was for a large award-winning senior living facility in Shanghai, in China. That was a great project and really interesting because we had to apply a lot of this cultural differences and understanding how this Chinese people might want their space. So, for example, one of the things that we did is we usually there are gardens and outdoor spaces that you can have in a clinic or like in a facility. And in Australia, usually we'll have garden beds or for example, like a fence because it might be a rural area and people are familiar with just like standing by the fence and talking to your neighbor. In the Chinese one, we had a pagoda. And if you ever go to China, you would know that pagodas and these outdoor, I guess like seating areas, a lot of people go there and they just talk to the people around them. It's a great sense of community. It's just a really nice, comfortable place to relax. So those were some of the different cultural nuances that we included into them.
Yeah, I've heard something about healing gardens.
I know there's a lot of talk about healing gardens now, and I think it's a great concept.
It should be great, especially in countries where it's not very cold and people can go out most of the time.
It was still in concept stage, but also in northern China, it gets very cold.
Oh,
And so
yeah.
you also get the problem of like, how do you go to a garden or how do you spend time outdoors? So one of the concepts we were working on was creating an indoor garden. So almost like a greenhouse where you can have, green spaces all throughout the year that people can go to see and visit. So it's not dependent on the weather because it is, especially if you're maybe a little bit older, you have to be a bit more concerned about the weather. We wanted to create a safe space that anyone can have access to nature.
Obviously, there are some challenges and some special things you need to keep in mind while designing for people with dementia. What were some of them?
I think the main challenge whenever you're designing a large facility or institution for people with dementia is that there's an expectation that you have to create a design that solves everyone's problems. But the reality is everyone's different. So everyone needs something different, especially like in their room or in the spaces that they're comfortable with. So that is always a big challenge balancing that because how can you create a space that's safe for everyone, but also allows them to thrive and to enjoy their life. And the best way to balance that I've found is really to give opportunities for people to personalize their space. So one of the challenges also in senior living facilities is that there's this really big divide between what is public and what is private space. So if you imagine like a senior living facility, these people only have a very private space, or they have a living room, which is suddenly shared with all these different strangers. So a lot of people are either in a very comfortable space, so their own home, like their own room, or in a public space where they feel very uncomfortable, because it's not theirs. They don't feel like they own it. They're welcome to go there, but you're sharing with a lot of people you might not be familiar with. So that's a challenge in the model itself. I think one way that has been addressed is to create an intermediate space. So to create a semi-public or semi-private space. So some facilities, they'll have your bedroom, and then they'll have a little space in the front, almost like a patio, where you can have a little chair, you have like a little, like a enclave where you can just sit down, and that's your space, and you can personalize it. And you can also invite people to come in. So that bridges the gap between the very stark divide of just very private or very public.
It also must serve as a place for family members. What needs do these people have when they meet their family members?
I mean, people have a lot of family members and a lot of visitors all the time, but it's interesting that a lot of traditional homes didn't account for this so much. Usually there might be one room, like for example, a private dining room, where you can, the person living in the home can go with all their family members together to have a meal together. But the actual living rooms themselves, but the very old traditional ones, usually it's a big hall or a big space, and you have all the chairs lined up along the wall.
Oh
And
yeah, it's not very private.
it's not very private. And for family members to come in, that's also not very comfortable. But for anyone really, like we don't have conversations in those kind of spaces. Usually you prefer to have them, in a smaller group. So that's another change that's been happening. And I think now in most nursing homes, you'll see that the spaces are a lot smaller. You might just have a sofa with like two chairs, so three or four people can sit together, or you might just have two chairs together, so two people can have a conversation. Because even in our day-to-day life, we have conversations in small groups. We don't have them in rooms of 25 facing each other.
Just in this case, if the dementia house, let's say, is big enough, then you have to have like specific number of these rooms because it might be 10 people having family members visit at the same time, probably, or it's not the case.
I think it usually depends on how the place is run. So I think usually because of space, you won't have more than two or three family members or people going to see their family members at a time. But because they come in at different times and different days, it's I think usually it's scheduled. So you wouldn't just come up unannounced because you also have to take into account how the staff are running the place and to make sure it works with everyone's schedule.
Also, there are some issues with places for older adults due to COVID. People who are older, they are more in risk of getting COVID on the one hand, and on the other hand, they cannot get their family members visiting them because of this risk. And they're lonely, depressed. Sometimes their friends or just people from the same house are getting COVID, and probably it's not the best atmosphere. There must be some design solutions to help them fight the situation.
I think it's very difficult because if I were in that situation, nothing would beat seeing somebody in person. Like we have technology where we can talk to our family members all the time, but it cannot really replace face-to-face interaction. I know technology is being used, and one of the things I've seen is there's like the toy seal. It's a robot, so but it looks alive, and that can be very therapeutic for some people. Just to hold something that feels like another living creature. I mean, ideally, you might even have pets in there. I've heard so many great things of homes where people bring in pets to interact with people because it just brings joy. I've heard of some more functional type of robots being used because I think one of the main challenges in hospitals as well is like lifting the patient up from the bed, moving them to get showers. So I know that there are some robots that help with the lifting and the safety of getting people around.
What about designing community spaces? Do you design for specific activities?
So a lot of the spaces when designing for like community or activities, the main thing is that it should be very flexible because for a lot of, I guess, senior living homes, there's a lot of different activities being held. So you've got people who are doing like painting classes, or you've got a lot of exercise and working out classes. So you need a space that's flexible to do a lot of that. But also a lot of activities just about big groups of people coming together. It's also about creating smaller groups because that's where you have really deep and meaningful conversations. So I would say one of the major factors in designing these community spaces is to have flexibility to allow these rooms to accommodate all these different activities. And another great space to have activities is always outside. It's incredibly important that everyone has access to outdoor or nature spaces, even if they're not outdoor, like in the winter here. Just safe outdoor spaces where they can relax and be comfortable and just be at one with nature. Healing gardens that are designed to stimulate all the different senses. So a lot of the times when we think of spaces, we might just think of the visual aspect of it, how it looks. But also the healing garden, what they're focusing on is all the other elements. So for example, the hearing, like what you can hear in the space. The smells, so sometimes you have a lot of like beautiful smelling gardens to stimulate memories and senses. You have touch, so a lot of the plants are specifically chosen for their unique textures or because they're safe to touch. And sometimes you even have like things that for taste. Sometimes you can like there are vegetable patches or there are certain plants you can eat that people can pick fruits off the tree. So these are spaces that sort of are very enriching because it's not just something you look at. It's something that you can be a part of and just be engrossed in that space at that time.
And what were your design process as well, designing these spaces and outdoor places as well.
So when we're designing these sort of spaces, usually we have to start with understanding what the users want and also like what the clients want as well. It always starts with understanding what the problem is and what we need to design for. Usually this process is a lot of workshops, a lot of interviews, a lot of conversations, and that's usually the bulk part of the work, and that's usually the part that I enjoy most because you never really design something for someone. You're designing it together. And a lot of times, maybe the clients have an idea of what they want, but they don't know exactly every little detail. So that's always the fun part of figuring out what are these things that we need to include. And then there's a lot of back and forth there when you have a concept and a design. And then when everyone's happy, that's when you move forward and you have huge teams working together to make these ideas into a reality. So you've got a lot of engineers, your designers, your architects, your project managers, everyone's working together to make it a success. In China, I'm very lucky that they can be from 2 to 4 years, but a lot of larger projects abroad can be up by 7 to 10 years.
And one last question I have is that you were working with very different cultures. Australian culture is very mixed, Chinese culture is very special, British culture is very special as well. What were some specific interesting aspects that you have noticed and you would love to share?
I think it's very easy to think that because these cultures can be very different, that people are very different, and we have to design very differently for all of them. But the foundation of any design is the same, no matter what culture you're in. And that's really rooted in understanding and working together with your users. Where cultures come in and influence design is in a lot of the nuances. In China, we were working with some clients, and the executives mentioned to us that when we're doing the workshops, usually we just bring all the stakeholders together to have a big workshop so everyone can share their thoughts and ideas. But the executives came up to us and said, we would like to have our workshops separate. So we want our younger staff to be together, we want our management to be get together, and we'll do the executives together. And the reason they did this is because they knew that culturally in China, people are very respectful of their elders and very respectful of hierarchy. And they knew that if you had the young staff together with anyone who's management, everything is perfect. They would never say anything bad because that's just cultural. They're not conditioned to be able to speak openly about problems because there's this idea of saving face or of being respectful. That's a very small change, but at the end, you're still able to get a lot of insights from these people. But we had to understand how to draw those insights out. We had one day with a workshop with all the executives. It was pretty much the exact same tasks across all three groups, but they knew that their comments were anonymous. They were more willing to share their true, honest thoughts. And eventually they knew that would come back to the top, but they were confident that it didn't have to come back to them personally.
And what about Australia?
I think because it's my hometown, it will always hold a special place in my heart. I think Australia, in terms of workshops and co-creation and design, is very open. You're in an Australian workshop, you'll see that there's a huge mix of people, and it's just bringing people from all walks of life. So in a hospital, it'd be you have your patients, you'd have your doctors, your staff, the people running the hospital all together, working together. You don't have to worry about what other people think. That's always very interesting, and very rich conversations can come from that as well. But that's also quite similar to the way it's done in the UK.
And I have 3 questions to you. Questions? Yeah. So I won't be commenting and you just have to answer and we will go to the next question. So what is the next big thing in healthcare?
That's a great question and a hard question. But I think artificial intelligence is going to really change how healthcare works.
If you could write anything on a billboard and hang it somewhere so that everybody can read, what would that be?
I think right now, given the current COVID climate, I would say get to know your neighbors.
And what healthcare trend are you skeptical about?
A lot of these like quick blood tests to find out all your symptoms and things. there was a big issue about that a year ago, so I'm still a little bit skeptical of what that's capable of achieving.
Your tip to healthcare designers, has it helped you to grow and probably will help them too?
I probably mentioned this already in our talk, but I think for me, the greatest lesson I learned is to never feel like you're designing for somebody, but to design with them. I think that's always the best foundation of any great design work.
Thank you for the conversation. It was such a pleasure to talk to you and to get to know more about stigmatized conditions. I really enjoyed it, and obviously much more aware of how we can help these people right now, how we can understand their needs better and support people with stigmatized conditions like incontinence and people with dementia as well. So thank you
Thank
for
you for having
that.
me. Thank you. It was great.